This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini on this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best.
You have to be a decision maker.
What it takes to get invited to the World Economic Forum.
We can shape the future in a positive way if we have also new innovative ideas.
The founder of the World Economic Forum says some slots get held open for young, unheard of innovators.
I was one of the first visitors to see him when he came out of prison in 90.
And Klaus Schwab on inviting Nelson Mandela.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Ed, going to Davos for the World Economic Forum, it's usually a huge deal.
Yeah, but, Denise, as you know, it's not happening in Davos, Switzerland this year, though, because of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's right, Ed. It'll be in Singapore this year, in May, instead of earlier in the year, and partly virtual.
But we did have a chance to hear from the founder and executive chairman of the forum, Klaus Schwab.
He spoke on the David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations.
And David begins here by asking Schwab about traditions at Davos and how it all gets put together. Check it out.
So, Klaus, let me ask you, in the end of January, for the last 50 years or so, the elites of the world, the most famous business people, the most famous heads of state, gather in Davos to talk about various global issues. This January, is that going to be possible?
Yes, they will come together again during the usual Davos week, but, of course, in a virtual form. It's so important to look at the agenda of 2021 and to shape the agenda. We are at the crossroads. But the virtual meeting is not enough. So we combine it with a meeting where people really physically will meet again later in May. Hopefully, vaccines and progress in testing will allow us to do so.
Now, last year, President Trump spoke. And you've had Xi Jinping in recent years. You've had Vladimir Putin, President of France, the Chancellor of Germany, leaders from all over the world. To get these leaders, do you have to call them and say you're personally invited? Or do they call you and say, I want to come?
No, usually the presence is the result of longer friendship in certain cases, or at least relationship. Just look at, I take a case, for example, Mrs. Merkel. When Chancellor, or Mrs. Merkel at that time, when there was the fall of the wall, and by the way, the World Economic Forum was very engaged and essential in the German reunification, because Chancellor Kohl and his East German counterpart met the first time in Davos and decided to go ahead with the unification. But at that time, there was a young member from Eastern Germany appointed to the cabinet as environmental minister. And we made her a young global leader. And she came regularly to Davos. And so out of, let's say, this first invitation, regular participation has developed over the last years. And I could go on and on. Usually the people who are coming to Davos are part of this, what I would call Davos community of regulars.
So of all the famous people that have come to make speeches, who was it that drew the biggest attention of all the people you had?
I think it's difficult because it was always related to the specific timing when someone came. For example, when President Trump came, he was the first year in the office. But for me, the most important or the most memorable participant certainly was Nelson Mandela.
So, Klaus, you've got a lot of prominent people coming, business people, government people. Do they call you sometime and say, my hotel is not adequate, or I need more passes, or what are the complaints, or how do you shield yourself from all these complaints that people might make about they need a bigger hotel room, or they need more entourage passes or something?
Because with most of those people I am in touch, more on an intellectual basis, on a political basis, on a conceptual basis. So fortunately, they don't always dare to call me if there are such matters, but they call my staff and really insist, because Davos is a place for skiing. The hotel infrastructure is not like in a big city. But I think everybody over time now accepts what is important is the personal contact, the frank exchange of ideas. So you make certain sacrifices in terms of your personal comfort.
Why did you pick Davos? There are many great cities in Switzerland. Why didn't you not do it in Geneva where you were living, or why not some other resort in Switzerland?
I wanted to avoid a big city. I wanted to create a true global village where people meet on the streets. Davos is a village. Davos had the necessary infrastructure in terms of hotels and also a great Congress House.
So for those who haven't been there, how do you get invited to go to Davos every year? Who gets to go?
You have to be a decision maker, either in politics or in business, but also in civil society. And in addition, we invite always young people, of course the media, scientists. So it's a true mirror of global stakeholders, which means of all walks of society.
If somebody is watching you and says, I've never been invited to Davos, I'd like to go, do I just send a letter to Klaus Schwab and say I'd like to come?
I would read the letter because I'm always curious about new people. And as an example, I just got an email. I don't know where he has my email address from a young girl in 16 years old in India, who has done extraordinary things to help the community in terms of practical approaches to deal with environmental issues, particularly with plastics. So we have a certain open house for everybody who has an innovative spirit, because we want to shape the future. And let's not forget, we can shape the future in a positive way if we have also new innovative ideas.
Now, some people say, well, Davos is for the elites. And every year when Davos occurs at the end of January, you get articles in newspapers saying, this is where the elites are gathering. How do you respond to people say it's just for the elites of the world?
Yes, of course. All the top decision makers are in Davos, but it's only half of the truth. You have, in addition, many people not very well known, particularly not known to the media. I just give you some examples. I invited Mrs. Ahern when she still was a member of the parliament. We invited people like Mandela. I was one of the first visitors to see him when he came out of prison in 90. So I brought him 92 to Davos. It was a remarkable historical event because it was the first time he came together with, at that time, President Clerk. And it was demonstrations that apartheid has stopped in South Africa. So there are many of those people, young, not very well known, but those are the people who shape the future.
Let's talk about your background first and then how you came to create what's known as Davos. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in a middle-sized town just north of Switzerland, in Germany, and I actually experience still the horrors of World War II. I remember how I was sitting with my teddy bear in our shelter. But we were actually fortunate because my father was working for a Swiss company and was also active for the International Red Cross. So we could cross the border at any time between Germany and France and Switzerland. And what struck me and what probably influenced my whole life was to cross a kind of line, an artificial line, the border between Switzerland and Germany. And on the one side, there was peace, and on the other side, there was war. I think it was a very important element for me and a driver to devote my life to dialogue, to reconciliation, to working together in order to solve issues.
And so you went to school then in Germany and in high school in Germany?
Yes, I went to high school in Germany, but then studied in Switzerland, where I did at the same time a studies in mechanical engineering. But at the same time, I studied economics. And I concluded both with a master's degree, of course, and afterwards with a doctorate. And then my father felt, in order to do real a career in business, you have to go to Harvard Business School. So I applied to Harvard Business School, was accepted. But then I wrote to Harvard Business School and said, look, to Dean Baker, look, I have two doctorates. I want to come to the second year immediately. And he wrote back, no way. So what happened afterwards, I found a school in the, at that time we didn't have the internet yet, it was a big catalog. I found a center which was called Litauer Center, and today is the Kennedy School. And I discovered if you are accepted at the Litauer Center, you can cross-register everywhere in the Harvard system. So that's what I did. I registered with the Kennedy School, went to all the classes of the Harvard Business School, second year, and suddenly I got an invitation from Dean Baker to have tea with him in this little president's house. And he said, you are the first one who outfoxed our system. From now on, cross-registering will only be possible for two courses or for two classes. But for me, this year at Harvard, it changed my life because I met also people like Henry Kissinger, John Kenneth Galbraith, and I became much more interested in political, general economic, societal problems.
So after you finished at Harvard, you came back to Germany or Switzerland?
I got a phone call from a famous Swiss industrialist, Mr. Schmidt-Heine, and he told me, look, you have the Harvard experience. I just merged two companies, one 10,000 people company with another big industrial group, the Sulzer Group, which still exists. Why don't you come and you are responsible for the merger? So I went through a hard school because I had to lay off people. But after 2 years, let's say the job was more or less finished. And I asked myself what to do now. And I got an offer from the University of Geneva to do teaching. And I felt with all the academic experience I have accumulated, business experience, I should spend 1 or 2 years teaching. At the same time, I got an offer from the German Machine Building Association. You have been at Harvard, you have business experience. Why don't you write a book for our members on modern management? So I sat down and asked myself, what is actually the purpose of a company? And that's when I came up with the stakeholder concept, which means that a company is not just an economic unit, but a social organism. And it has to serve all those who depend on the company, who have a stake in the company, like the people working in the company, the community it is active in. So that was the big, let's say, beginning actually of the Davos idea, because the Davos idea is the stakeholder capitalism, the stakeholder responsibility.
Okay, so you're back at the University of Geneva, you're teaching economics, is that what you're teaching?
I was teaching actually leadership, corporate management. And then as a professor I should say frankly, a little bit bored after all the previous experience. I had written this book. Then I felt, why not to create a platform where business leaders could meet their stakeholders, which means political leaders, but also outstanding voices of society. So I had made some savings, and I got some money from my parents, and that's how I started the Davos platform, which is now called the World Economic Forum. And actually, I incorporated it immediately as a not-for-profit foundation because I recognized if I wanted to attract governments, it cannot be a for-profit, a profit-making venture.
So had you made it a for-profit venture, you think it would not have become as big as it has become?
No, certainly not, because now we have the trust of everybody, because people know we are serving a purpose and we are not serving our own interests.
What year was it that you had your first conference?
It was 1971, and there were 444 people. And actually, I hired one employee because I needed some experience in how to run a conference. So that's how I met my wife. She was my first Hilde, my first collaborator.
So you've now been married for how many years?
Next year it will be 50 years, David.
50 years, okay. So you're going to have a big party at Davos to celebrate the 50th wedding anniversary?
No, we are more, well, let's say, a private family. I think we will do it. We married in a very little church in a mountain valley, which cannot, give room to more than probably 20, 30 people. So we will go back, certainly, to the church if COVID allows us to do so.
What was it that propelled Davos, as we're calling it now, or World Economic Forum, to go from a 444-person event to a global phenomenon? What was it that actually changed things that made it so popular and so important to people to attend?
I think if I look over the last 50 years, it is the conviction that the big issues in the world need a collaborative approach. Business has to interact with government leaders, but also if you want to plan long term, you have to know how customers feel, how the young generation feels, what experts are thinking. So Davos became a place where you really could absorb what the future will bring you. I think intellectual or contextual intelligence, as I would, to know what's going on, not only now, but what will happen in the future, to connect the dots, became more and more important for business leaders when they looked at their long-term strategies.
Over the years, the 50 years or so, have there been one or two or three events that have happened at Davos where a global leader of one country met with a global leader of another country, and actually as a result, a peace agreement broke out or something like that happened? Does that happen very much?
It happens. For example, we at a very critical moment, 30 years ago, we prevented probably a war between Turkey and Greece, even if unfortunately we didn't solve the animosity. We were the only platform for many years which brought Israeli leadership and the Arab leadership together in Davos, as you know, David. We try always to be a platform of good services. I would even say in the best Swiss tradition, because like Switzerland, the World Economic Forum is independent, impartial, and non-political.
So many people that build organizations like yours, who's been over 50 years now, they want them to continue forever. What do you hope will happen subsequent to your not being the executive chair? Will it continue, or can it not continue without you?
I have built a very strong governance structure, not only with the board of trustees, but also with the managing board. The forum is now an organization with offices around the world, in China, Tokyo, US twice, and also we have our Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution in San Francisco. I think there are many capable people, and if something happened to me, I think the spirit would survive.
What is it you're most proud of having created over the 50-year period of time? It's a gathering place or a network of our community. What is it that makes you most proud of what you've done?
I think there are many, many examples where we took an initiative or we provided a solution. I'm personally very proud, maybe as an academic, that stakeholder capitalism is now broadly accepted and has been even in the corona crisis shown as being a more robust a model for a business compared to one company which is only aiming at short-term profits.
So Klaus, now when you call somebody, any head of state in the world, or you email anybody, does it take more than 5 minutes or 2 minutes or a minute for you to get a call back? Because, you know, everybody knows you, everybody wants to talk to you. How hard is it for you to get anybody on the phone? I assume not too hard.
I would say it's not too hard, but certainly not within a minute, or sometimes it takes a week. Most people, see, I have met every leader probably around the world, with the exception of the last pope. I try to take out of all those meetings the very best. And David, if I may, when you meet those people, you ask yourself, what makes a leader today? I have a very simple definition. It takes brains, soul, heart, and muscles. Now, the brain stands for professionalism. You have to know what you are dealing with. The soul stands for having a compass which gives you direction. It may be a vision, it's your values. And the heart is for passion. You have to be passionate about what you are doing. And the muscles is for being able to implement your ideas, your vision, to translate your values. And I have to say, when I look around in the world, all the leaders I have met, there are actually only very few who respond to all four criteria. But again, the person who is outstanding, the best role model, is certainly Nelson Mandela.
Well, I'm going to just conclude by saying I've met a lot of great leaders as well, but I would also say one that I know who has brains, soul, heart, and muscle is Klaus Schwab. So congratulations on what you have done, Klaus. I hope you're very proud of what you built, and I look forward to seeing you not too long from now.
Thank you very much, David.
And you've been listening to Klaus Schwab. He's founder and executive chairman of the World Economic Forum on the David Rubenstein Show Peer-to-Peer Conversations. And that's it for this hour of Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
This is Bloomberg.